Welcome to the Emmy Vui Show. Our show focuses on feng shui, architecture, and related topics. We are here with Dan Watson, and our topic today is about Egypt and Damanhur, spiritual journeys. Before I begin, Dr. Dan Watson is a psychologist and the director of the La Ho Chi Institute, an international healing center, and integrative healthcare research institute. Methodologies include guided imagery, meditation, yogic breathing, self-reflexology, and vocal toning. La Ho Chi's Institute's mission is in assisting others in spiritual awareness, self-healing, self-empowerment, and unconditional love. Welcome, Dan Watson.
Thank you, Emmy. It's good to be here.
Thank you for being here, Dan Watson.
My pleasure.
You consider yourself a spiritual psychologist too, right? Is that correct?
Yes, I got that from observing and reading and following the material from Doreen Virtue, who's pretty well known in the public eye now for doing angel therapy cards and a lot of other spiritual psychology topics and books. So that's really kind of where I originally had started, but there wasn't really that term yet, wasn't out there in the public yet. And she's kind of the first person in the mainstream to really put that title after her name. And that really explains more or less where my focus and my emphasis has been, even though it's traditionally in clinical psychology, but with the focus on transpersonal and psychosynthesis. But if you really were to look at those two things, those are more spiritually oriented, spiritually focused branches of psychology that go more into these realms of energy healing and meditation and all sorts of mind, body, and spirit technologies.
So, Dan, when you're talking about you have a PhD in psychology. Is that Western psychology?
Yes, that's traditional psychology.
What is traditional psychology?
Traditional psychology would be going through...
Is that based under, like one of the teachings is Freud? Is that it?
Well, in a traditional psychotherapy psychology program, you first get a master's and then you go into the PhD program. And, of course, you have to cover all the theories of all the main psychologists and family systems and all the basics. And then as you develop through your PhD program, you usually focus on something of your interest to you, whether it's psychoanalysis or family therapy systems, or in my case, it was more of the mind-body-spirit, psychophysiology, biofeedback, guided imagery, hypnosis, psychosynthesis. And so then my dissertation went even further in that direction, where I included hands-on healing and the history of energy healing, and applying that, integrating that with medicine and psychology as being the future wave of where we're headed. So this is what's happening now, because I wrote that, completed that dissertation in 1999, and now since then, there's been just a huge explosion of spiritual techniques and energy healing, and you're just seeing a lot of more of it being accepted into the mainstream and integrated by nurses and doctors.
Dan, I have experienced, of course, your healing for a number of years. And when did you start getting these callings to do this type of work? In what capacity was that?
Well,
did you have
about going back to around 1986 when I first enrolled in my doctoral program. And the doctoral program actually began with the master's program, but I wanted to keep it all in the same school. I didn't want to go from one school to the other because I liked what I initially found out and discovered that they had, which was the first mind-body, what they called it behavioral medicine, but the better term for it is mind-body medicine program. It was the first in the whole United States. It was started in 1980, so I got into the program in 1986, and it really sounded like the kind of psychology that I wanted to explore, because it was about mind-body medicine. It was about emotions, about using your mind, about accessing things beyond just the verbal analysis form of psychology. So it really appealed to me because my background and family, my father's a physician, so I always had an interest in that, but it wasn't quite to follow through with that. It was more working with people in a psychological way. And so these two fields kind of, they seem to blend, and there's a point in between where this mind-body medicine, psychophysiology, and behavioral medicine in the field of psychology seem to bring those two fields together.
Dan, we talked about the questions that I was going to ask you, and I wanted to kind of go backwards because I just read something about Egypt, and I wanted to start off with that question because if there are architects listening out there, the pyramids of Egypt, and I even visited Egypt back in 1986, and I understand that you have visited Egypt on numerous occasions, as much as twice a year or something like that.
Well, actually, we've just been three times now.
Three times a year, so...
No, not three times a year, just three times total.
Oh, three times total, but
yes.
Within the last 2 years, though.
In the last 2 years, we've been once... the last two Novembers we've been.
Well, that's a lot. I mean, I don't think you know, most people, unless their family's from Egypt, they would go.
Right.
But you don't have family in Egypt, right?
No, we've been leading tours there for the purpose of contacting spiritual energies and also connecting with past life energies that are there. Just like if you go somewhere on this planet, there's going to be a strong feeling that you may get in certain places. You may not be aware of it, and you may be aware of it. And these are energies that are connecting with parts of you, parts of your history, parts of your DNA, and they can be very significant experiences. They can help you evolve and help you develop more of yourself and become aware of things, perhaps heal things that have been unresolved related to issues connected to those lifetimes or those places on the planet. So there's a lot of interesting possibilities when you travel to places like this.
So where specifically do you go to? Or do you go to the pyramids of Giza?
Yes, I mean that's one of many places. We go to all the major temples along the Nile, and each one of those they believe are also corresponding to the chakras of the body. And they each have different histories of rituals and gods and goddesses that were worshipped there. So there's different feelings in each one of them. And it's just an interesting thing to go and experience what those are and to immerse yourself in the rich history that apparently when you go there, you look at a stone structure that, you know, looks like it's a ruin, more or less, but on the other hand, there's an enormous amount of energy that you can feel emanating from it. So the more sensitive you are, the more you can be aware of the energies and vibrations and subtle frequencies that are there, and maybe even tap into things that have been there from the past. It's a place where a lot of authors and writers who are clairvoyant have had channeling experiences and meditations and spontaneous healings, and also going there for the purpose of doing a certain ritual to access a particular energy or a lifetime. So there's a lot of different ways you can approach going to one of these places, and I recommend if anybody does go to approach it with that awareness. It is a sacred site, and it has sacred energies that are very palpable. So it's something that you can have a much deeper and richer experience other than just going there as a tourist.
Yes, I just read a lot of, well, I read some very amazing information about the pyramids of Egypt and the mysteries behind it.
Well, there's a lot of information about it, and specifically, there's a specific ratio of pyramids. And that particular ratio, and no other ratio like it, but this one particular ratio of the Great Pyramid, they have found in research that if you replicate that exact proportional shape and put like a razor blade inside of it, it will sharpen the razor blade. Other, you know, strange phenomena like that have been found.
I don't understand what you just said.
Well, there are things that the ancient Egyptians...
You said razor blade.
They knew things that were beyond our comprehension, where they got this information from. So when they built certain structures, they did it with exact proportions. And if you try to build the same thing without the same proportions exactly, it doesn't have the same effect or power. And they've actually done scientific studies where they've taken the exact proportions of this particular pyramid shape that the Great Pyramids formed out of, and things can, like a piece of metal can be sharpened by putting it in there. There's some kind of frequency field that's created within that particular ratio structure of that particular pyramidal shape. So these are phenomena that the ancients knew, which relates to sacred geometry and other dynamics. So these are some of the laws of physics that they were able to capture in a form or a shape and use them for various
specifically
things.
On your gift, how do you develop your gifts, or how do you I guess you're going to tell people to go to your workshops or something
like
that.
Yes, come to the La Ho Chi Institute workshops.
But when I had sessions with you, I guess it doesn't have to be necessarily private because I'm your client. So.
You're choosing to share that, yes.
Yeah, I'm choosing to share that, and you seem to have a lot of descriptions that I can't possibly fathom in my own guided imagery meditation. Sometimes you mention about flowers or things, and then I might be sitting in the flower, or just amazing things. It's amazing, and I'm sure that every time you visit these places, you get recharged.
Yes, and the thing is that every single individual on this planet, every life form, plant, animal, person, human, whatever life form it is made up of an energy field and is comprised of energy. So all the cells in your body have different chemicals like salt and water, and those things conduct energy like electricity. So you're a walking electrical unit of flowing energy, and as an energy field that you are, you're sensitive to all kinds of energy fields and all kinds of forces. And it's a very complex thing that we really are. And in that entire spectrum is the innate ability and actual need to be touched and to touch as well. And this is a basic human need to function. They've already proven that back in the turn of the century, about 1900, when they were trying to introduce ways of reducing infant mortality in hospitals, and they ended up going the wrong direction because they sterilized everything and they kept the fathers away from the babies. They did all these things that basically distanced the baby from having human touch, and the infant mortality rate shot up through the ceiling, went out to almost 100%. And they found that the babies that were born in the slums and the poor neighborhoods where there wasn't any hygiene were thriving. So they determined after researching why that was true is because those children were receiving touch and love and caring, and that was more important for actual growth. So as adults, most adults are touch deprived, and the Touch Institute in Florida. Tiffany Fields was the one that started that, the first institute of its kind, has proven that in different countries you will notice a lot of touching, like let's say in Italy, places like that. But then when you get into England and America, you have a serious touch deprivation.
Okay. Dan Watson, we are here with Dr. Dan Watson. We're going to go on a break. Dan Watson is a psychologist and director of the La Ho Chi Institute. I am Emmy Louie, and you are listening to The Emmy Louie Show. We'll be back. We are back. I am Emmy Louie, and you are listening to The Emmy Louie Show. We are here with Dr. Dan Watson, psychologist and director of the La Ho Chi Institute. We're talking about spiritual journeys, Egypt, and Damanhur. And is there anything else you want to talk about specifically in regards to Egypt and the journeys that you have?
Yes. The connection between the work that I do, my wife and I did the La Ho Chi Institute teaching hands-on healing, is very connected and tied to energy healing, and it's very connected to the other place that we take tours to, which is Damanhur, Italy, which is also named after an Egyptian city called the City of Light. And that is, the hands-on healing was done in ancient Egypt. There's lots of hieroglyphs where you can see that they were doing their various kinds of energy healing. So this is one of the most ancient and spiritual of the techniques. And in other cultures, you'll find hands-on healing was part of their tradition of teaching in the wisdom schools and the mystery schools. And it was also a way of healing because it was one of the more basic forms of healing in those days. Now we have all this high technology. We've got, you know, more people that are having more problems. So it makes sense that there's this resurgence of energy healing coming back into our society and bringing back an ancient technology that is really fundamental to the nervous system of the body and the overall evolution, both spiritually and emotionally, for the individual. So that's a significant tie-in between Egypt and the spiritual community in Damanhur, Italy, and the work that we teach. So
why are you so passionate about Damanhur?
Yeah, that's a significant connection between all of those. Excuse me, what do you say?
Why are you so passionate about Damanhur? And Damanhur is located near Turin.
Damanhur is located 1 hour north of Turin. It's
Turin, okay.
Yeah, northwest Italy, and it's in the foothills there on the mountain range. And I did a interview yesterday, a 2-hour interview, a radio show in Seattle, Contact Radio, and then last night I did a presentation at a huge center here in Asheville. And the significance of it is that this place called Damanhur, which is named after an Egyptian city in Egypt, just south of Alexandria. The name Damanhur means City of Light. And this is a very appropriate name for this community. It's the largest and most successful intentional community in the world based on spiritual, social, and political research. And in their 32 years now of existence in this place, they've created not only their own currency, their own constitution, they have 40 different economic activities that did not exist when they first arrived there. They've created them themselves, and they've also been elected to political councils in neighboring towns, and help to restore and to bring life and vitality back into this region. So they've created their own, which is available to anybody, organic grocery store. It's got hospitals. They've got DNA laboratories. They've got mosaic, tile, and sculpture studios. They have art restoration studios. They have state-of-the-art physical therapy, massage. They've got prana therapy, which is also a form of energy healing. They've got the top silk dye manufacturer in all of Europe. So it's just to name just a few things they've got there, and you wonder, how could somebody have created this much in such a short period of time and be so rich and diverse? And it's based on the founder. His name is Alberto Araudi, which is his Italian name. His name in Damanhur is Falco, and Falco is falcon. So one of the things that he had based his research on was looking at how to build a community that would be based on optimism and as well as working with your hands to create and having a social system that allowed people to live together harmoniously. So because they've been so successful for so long, and now they're 1,000 people, that the sociologists, psychologists, researchers, and scientists are going to be coming there this June for the largest intentional community conference in the world that's being hosted there for the purpose of seriously looking at how they can write a new chapter into the annals of sociology and academia, because for a long time the sociologists have considered Dahmer as being large enough and significant enough of a community that's been so successful that they really do need to rewrite their theories on communal living.
So, Sam, what is intentional community? I know I hear that a lot.
Yeah,
so
intentional community.
Versus what?
Well, intentional community would be a community where everyone focuses on working together. It's kind of like a co-op of all the businesses, for instance, and everybody working harmoniously together, everybody working to better themselves and the planet so that you don't have a lot of divergent energies and people with other agendas, because that's typically how most places, most civilizations, most cities work. And everybody's got their own thing they're doing, but there's a lot of problem with pollution, with crime, with you name it. But in an intentional community, it's based on factoring in ways of avoiding those, the big issues. So like, for instance, in Dahmer, there is no police force. They don't need one. They have a fire department, they have a rescue team, they have all those things, but they don't have a police force because there's nothing there that people are doing that would require them to have a police force. They're so focused on evolution and evolving themselves and actually working really hard.
So let's talk about the police force. What about young children, let's just say a teenage boy?
Yeah.
Usually they, not to pick on teenage boys or whatever.
Sure, I understand what you're saying.
That kind of energy.
Yeah.
The mischievous energy depicted by even like in the Hindu, who's that blue god? What am I thinking of? Krishna. I mean, Krishna was depicted in Hinduism where he was very mischievous.
Right.
That energy. But what about that mischievous type of energy? How is that?
Well, the mischievous energy.
Dominant.
Yeah, the mischievous energy can be channeled to create something, and so there's plenty of opportunity to create things in Dahmer, whether it's building something or whatever that may be. But they also have a very vast system of workshops and support that everybody who lives there is participating in all the time, which is to help you work through your own issues, develop yourself, and get along with other people, because they live in families of, let's say, 20 people in a house.
So are you saying that when you go to Dahmer, it's almost like another planet where there's not the kind of regular issues that the rest of the world has, and it's very refreshing?
Yes. Now, it's not to say that people don't go through a lot. In order to live in a place like this, you have to commit to that and also adapt. Now, in our society, and in a lot of other cultures, this whole idea of communal living is kind of foreign to us.
Yeah, it's often considered written off like, communist or whatever it is. A communist, it has, and I don't even want to mention that because then we're bringing that kind of energy of what we've been programmed to think of as what it is. So we are eliminating our past conceivances of what this means.
Right. So, for instance, in Europe, it's very common for people to live with three generations of people in a house. And it's a common thing. You see it a lot. And so they've had that in their history for so long, it's not foreign for them to move into a house that has maybe 20 people in it. But over here, everybody, you know, wants to be, you know, in their own space. So it's a very different way of adapting to a lifestyle. But in that particular lifestyle in Domherr, you don't have to necessarily live in that way because there's three levels of citizenship there. And the first level, you could own your own apartment and just be involved with all these different activities that you're interested in and so on, and then go back to your apartment. And that's some of the people have done that. But then as you go a little deeper into the citizenship there, you could choose to move into what they call a nucleo, which is a house of maybe 20 people. But in that sense, you're also getting a lot of benefits because you're pooling all your resources together, and you're also creating a really strong family bond, and you're learning how to also work harmoniously with a lot of people in different social situations. And because of that, Domherr has been able to manifest enormous amounts of achievement, and including building the largest underground temple in the world that's dedicated to art and spirituality. It's also the largest healing instrument in the world, and it's considered the eighth wonder of the world. It has the two largest Tiffany glass domes in it. It also has the largest terracotta ceiling, and they're all works of art. They're masterworks of art. And you can see those online. Go to Domherr, Damanhur.org, and you can surf their website. You can also go to our website, lahochicenter.com, LAHOCHICENTER.com, and we have a Magical Journey to Domherr link. And you click on that, and it will take you to an image, like a side view, like a cutout view of the whole temple. And then you can go into different rooms, just click on it, and go inside and see the room. It's truly a wonder of the world. So these are just a few of the things that they've manifested and created in such a short period of time that, like the leader said, founder, I should say, most countries wouldn't be able to afford creating something like that because there'd be too much red tape and too many disagreements and on and on. Mm-hmm. But in the intentional community is where people can actually take an idea or project and bring it to fruition very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the big differences between like a modern society versus an intentional community.
Okay, we are here with Dr. Dan Watson, director of the Lahochi Institute. I am Emmy Louie. You are listening to the Emmy Louie Show, and we will be back. We'll take a 2-minute break. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie. You are listening to the Emmy Louie Show. You can also send me an email about any of your comments at emy@emyloue.ie. You can also visit my website to look at archives at www.emyloue.com. We are back with Dr. Dan Watson, psychologist and director of the Lahochi Institute. We're talking about Domherr, which is an independent country. Is that correct, in Italy?
No, actually, they're a federation. They're considered a federation by the Italian government. In 1979, they were given that recognition. They have their own currency, which is the equivalent to the euro. So when you go there, this is one of their secrets to their economic success, that you bring the euro to one of the buildings there and you exchange it for what they call credito. And then while you're there, maybe a week, 2 weeks, however long you stay there, when you go eat or purchase things, you use their money, and then at the end, you exchange it back. You don't lose anything because it's the same value. So it's a really interesting system, and it's just another one of the unique things about Domherr. And in fact, the coins themselves are works of art. They're pieces of replicas of some of the murals that you see in the temples or other structures. So they're they're not just a regular coin, an actual mm-hmm. piece of art. So that as you're holding this, the energy that's held in it and the energy that's being used for it is also being represented as a piece of art and beauty. And that's one of the main themes of Dominar, is living everyday life with more purpose and intention, focused on beauty, art, and harmony. So it's a very fascinating.
I have two questions, Dan. You said that the Dominar is around 30 years old.
Yeah.
What's happening to the second generation or the first generation of children that have been raised there? Do they move out, or do they stay, or what is going on with that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can't tell you the exact stats on that, but I do know from having spoken with some of the young people there in different age groups that what generally happens is they, at, like you said before, as they get to be, you know, a young teenager, they're, especially the boys, they're like, want to see what it's like out in the world.
Yeah, they want to, whatever, sow their wild oats, whatever
right.
You want to call it.
So they go down to Turin, for instance. It's a big city.
Turin. That's the place to paint the town, right?
That's the place to go wild. So they go to Turin, and maybe they live there for a year or something, but they usually come back, and you know, they say, wow, it's that was great, but I prefer it here because there's so much more meaning and more purpose and more connection and more support, and there's just so many things that I can experience here that I can't experience in the city. But there are people who have come to Dominar who were maybe late teens or early 20s when they first came, and maybe they came with their mother or something, and they decided after a couple of years that they wanted to, you know, try other things. So there's it's all spectrums of individual experiences, and some people may have been there for many years and then decide, or they meet somebody and they decide they want to go explore the world. So there's just different, you know, it's just like in regular societies anywhere else. You know, people may be drawn to follow a mission or some other purpose in their life, and it doesn't mean continuing to live in Dominar. So it's open to... You know.
I have a very mundane question. I grew up
sure.
in Hawaii, and I don't know if there's any relation, but people are surprised when I tell people that people who live in Hawaii, and I'm staying in Honolulu,
uh-huh.
they usually go to Las Vegas to vacation, and people who don't live in Hawaii say, why would you want to go to Las Vegas?
Right.
Well, for one reason, there's usually very good deals to go to Vegas, and...
Right.
My speculation is that it's the opposite of Hawaii, where you stay totally indoors,
right?
And it's always dark indoors, and it's just the opposite, almost in a lot of ways. And
opposite of calm.
Yeah. There's something that is extremely wild compared to growing up in Hawaii. I mean, not wild in a like
right.
nature wild, but just kind of provocative or whatever.
Right.
So
my
question is, where do Dominarians vacation? Or do
they have a fantastic tradition where part of the Dominarians will stay to, you know, take care of the home front, all the stores and everything, and then like half of them will travel down south of Italy, because Italy is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. I mean, there's so much Italy to explore that it's just, you know, you could spend your whole life exploring Italy. And even the Italians love going to other places within Italy. So they're, imagine being in the way up north and then having all these beautiful beaches and regions south in Italy. So they just travel south and go to a real magical beach that they...
Where is Turin? Turin
and Dominar are both in the northwestern...
What's the other closest biggest city?
Well, Milan is a little bit east.
Okay, that's pretty north then.
Yeah, and then Venice is east,
okay.
more east than that. So
okay,
they're all the upper northern region cities up there. And if you go way down south, you get all these beach towns, and they have been going there for years. And what they do is they also, while they're having beach time, they're doing esoteric physics, and they're continuing to, you know, learn and study. So they're They're constantly studying and learning esoteric and healing and all sorts of
stuff. Are you talking about the Italian Riviera?
I'm talking about, I don't know if exactly the Italian Riviera, but it's south. It's about 9 hours south, I think, that's where they go. But,
oh, that's even south.
South. I mean, you can go a long way down south.
But those areas are not, because I lived in Italy for 4 to 5 months, and I lived in Rome and went down to Naples, Italy, not Naples, Florida. But the thing is that those towns are towns. I think they don't. I mean, they're cities.
Yeah, they don't go to those places. They go to these remote beaches that have.
So they don't have that inclination to what I would say the similar inclination where people from Honolulu go to Las Vegas.
No, the thing about Dalmatians is that they're very their life is very different from what you or I or any most other people experience because they have so much activity every day of their life based on different meditation school and this and that. They have their whole day is so filled. And they don't, it's like there's really no TV, you don't see TV.
So there's no sense that you need to go somewhere, you need to escape from something. That's what you're saying,
you don't
right?
escape
That's
from
what
something.
Your implication is.
The only thing they're escaping is just their work day, but not their environment. Their
because
environment.
I want to tell you that in Honolulu, and I'm not just talking about Honolulu, I'm actually... you could visit anywhere in Orlando. You could go to any tourist town. I'm not talking on behalf of all tourist towns, but I've noticed when I go to Waikiki Beach, having grown up there, not in Waikiki Beach, but that a lot of people do not act like how you would they would normally act
right.
if they were back at home. In other words, they probably would act very obnoxious. And I wouldn't say disrespectful, but in a very almost what you'd call a Superman and Clark Kent kind of way, where their regular lives, quote unquote, are suppressed because they have to obey these social norms.
Right.
And then when they go to Hawaii, they're the Superman and they do whatever they want.
Right.
So can you address the psychology
That's one of the secrets to Dominator is that they've created an environment where they have all kinds of opportunities through theater productions, through courses, through there's many, many ways that they get to channel their sub-personalities, other parts of themselves that have a desire and a need to be acted out, worked on, to be expressed, and this is part of the field of psychology that I especially was focusing in, and you see a lot of it today. And if you don't do that, then negative things can occur where people act out in the way that you're talking about because they repress that so much that when they actually get out of this environment that they felt they've been trapped in, then they do things that are really disrespectful or don't have a lot of awareness or consciousness.
Can you just use one example? That Dominarians use that non-Dominarians don't use?
For instance,
that could be possibly translated to non-Dominarian culture?
Well, for instance, when you have an opportunity to, let's say, take up an art class and express yourself in a certain emotion and then maybe sculpt that in clay and then act it out or perhaps be able to look at those issues and have a dialogue, have an inner dialogue, or maybe do a guided imagery exercise where you go into these different areas and different parts of yourself, past life things. There's many different ways that Dominarians use and approach these parts of ourselves through different techniques, and as a result, they get to express themselves, they get to work themselves through, and also as a result, they create new energies, new ideas, and things then manifest that normally wouldn't manifest, new ways.
Now, when you say expression, there is expression, but is it because of the way it's expressed?
Oh, yes.
It's so immediate where if I wanted to express myself, I would have to go to an art gallery, or
right.
I would have to go to a discotheque, or I would have to turn on music, whereas this is much more infused
well,
together.
Well, this is, like I said, again, going back to the word intentional. This is an intentional use of doing this that ends up benefiting not only yourself but the community as well, versus just going to some place and, you know, getting out your frustrations. And of course, they also have music and concerts, and so they have the full spectrum of everything that we have. It's just that they do it in such a more well-rounded and more healthy way that they don't have a desire or need to be self-destructive or to be destructive to other people.
And you can only understand that, fully understand that, if you go there and experience it, right?
Yeah, I mean, to experience what I'm talking about, I can talk about it, and maybe you have experienced it before, or maybe you've seen it in other situations, but not that often. But to see it on a full scale with 1,000 people doing it all the time, every day, and then also seeing how hard they work and how much they accomplish, and you realize, well, nobody's getting, you know, nobody's beating anybody up, nobody's, I mean, you know, the kind of things that they need medical help for, which they have their own, are just typical everyday things, like maybe just, you know, injuring your back from lifting a rock or,
you know, exactly.
Okay, something hereditary. But
we are talking with Dr. Dan Watson, and we will take a two-minute break, and I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to The Emmy Louie Show. We'll be back. Hi, I am Emmy Louie, and welcome back. We are talking with Dan Watson about Domin Her, a federation in Italy, located near Turin, Italy. Or is it Turin?
Well, actually, in Italy, it's Torino.
Torino. How do you spell that?
T-O-R-I-N-O.
Okay.
But over here, we call it Turin, T-U-R-I-N, which is also the home of the Shroud of Turin.
The Shroud of Turin. I thought, well, okay.
Right.
Let's go back to what we were talking about, this new social paradigm about Domin Her. I have another question is, when you talk about 20 people, and you said that it's called the Nudio, or is it?
Nucleo. Like
Nucleo.
A nucleus?
I'm sorry.
Instead of a nucleus, it's called Nucleo.
Okay, Nucleo, when you say 20 people, how did they arrive at 20 people per household?
Well, that's a good question as well. I can only guess, and I assume that, and actually there's been some changes recently in how they've worked that, because Nucleo, I mean, let's imagine living in a house with 20 people. Well, the house can only be so big and have so many bathrooms, maybe one even, for 20 people, who knows? Depending on
you could fit 20 people in a lot of these United States houses and then some.
Right, but in actuality, each person has their own separate room that they sleep in, and
they
have their own room.
Each person?
Yes, they have their own room, but
so you would have to have 20 rooms.
But everything else is shared, so the common eating area, living room, all that, everything else is common. Except for their own private room.
So what is that new definition called then? It's not really called, it's not a freestanding home, is it? What kind of, it's called a nucleo.
Oh no, nucleo is just the term of the family unit.
The family unit.
Which is like, basically, it's a sub intentional community. So Domin Her is really it's really made up of 44, I think it is now, 44 sub-communities
44
spread out
Nucleo.
Over this region. Yeah.
Yes.
And then, but they all are part of the same federation of Domin Her. So the So they're all part of the same social, spiritual unit, but they're made up of all these different little.
Okay.
Nucleos.
So these 20 people, these nucleos, I understand they're not of blood ties. Or can it be?
No. I mean, well, there could be, let's say, three or four couples that have children. There could be a grandmother, and there could be some teenagers there, and they could be related or not related. So it's kind of like when you go somewhere, maybe you're more attracted to certain people and certain activities. Like maybe one group has a lot of people that are the ones that teach a lot and do a lot of speaking in Domineur, and another group are the people that do a lot of cooking, like they have
a
restaurant.
Well, how does that work? Because I was thinking, let's just say if I was born there and I grew up in a nucleo that had to do with, let's just say they were all musicians, like whatever my
well, they're actually not all the same, but there may be, you know, a concentration of a certain kind of...
And then when I grow up, I didn't want to stay in that nucleo, and
you
I
can
had
move
to jump
to another
over
one.
To another one.
You
so
just
that's
move.
How it works.
So basically, you walk over and you say, you know, you interview with them. You say, I'd like to, and so they work it out and see if it matches, and then so people can move around like that. Because there's so many and it's so large, you know, there's a lot of opportunities, and it's the same with their lifestyle, and the same with the things that they do. They're encouraged, and they often will do 3 or 4 different things in one day, and in that process, this is psychosynthesis at the core. Is that they get to develop parts of themselves that normally they wouldn't if they did the same job, you know, from 8 hours a day, 40 days a week, I mean 40 hours a week, and never did anything else except maybe just, you know, a little bit on the weekend. Whereas
actually, I heard that you, in the tape, the Domineur tape, that people usually have 2 quote-unquote jobs.
Yeah.
And my personal view is that we should even have more than that because of globalization and the fact that there's so many technologies that are developed. Every time something's developed, our job could be at stake. So I think that we should even have more than 2 jobs. We should be trained in 3 or 4 or 5 jobs.
Exactly. And also that reality, as a practical function and a reality in an intentional community, it really helps to create a balance and diversity, because sometimes it's more therapeutic and more beneficial, let's say, for you to do something more simple for the next couple of hours, like sitting in the field and helping with the plant communication or concert with the trees or something, and then go down and maybe help serve food, you know, at this one restaurant, and then go back to working in the main office, you know, fielding phone calls. It's like it gives you a more well-balanced, well-rounded experience of life, and it keeps you from getting stuck in a rut. And that's one of the big things in Domineur that they've put into their system or their way of approaching everything, is to find ways of preventing people from getting stuck in ruts where they begin to then resent what they're doing and find themselves, not satisfied.
I have 2 questions.
Sure.
When we talk about Domineur, we said what things that Domineur has. Does Domineur have the following things or don't have them? Do they have bureaucrats, doctors, lawyers, and politicians?
Yes. They have all those things. They actually have some really advanced DNA researchers, and I got to go to their first DNA conference, and they had biologists and cardiologists and scientists from all over Italy that came to that conference, because this was a regular peer-reviewed scientific journal research study that they did. And in fact, the main researcher, this very brilliant woman there in Domineur, found a new protein in the heart and actually named it after her. So, and part of that also is another practical reason. They need to, you know, look at the survival of not only, you know, the human species, but other species that are living on the earth. And a government, let's say Russia or some other place, that ends up having a meltdown, and then there's toxic radioactive waste flying over, you know, Europe, and they say, oh, don't worry about it, you know, the food's going to be okay. Well, they're not going to take the word of some other country saying that, so they'll go out and test things, and sure enough, for at least 1 to 2 years during several years ago, they actually did not eat certain things, a lot of those items, because they were contaminated, and they found that through their own testing. Now, the government would be very slow to come out and say, oh, yes, there was contamination. By that point, people have already consumed that and been contaminated.
Well, when you said the government, what government?
Other governments, like, let's say, Russian governments or other countries that have made a big environmental catastrophe. They're not going to be so willing to come out and say, oh, by the way, you know, the produce in this region of the world has been contaminated by our mistake. They're not going to say that. So in order to protect themselves and to be, you know, to be more preventative in their health, they actually will research and study and analyze the healthiness and the cleanliness of the produce and the things around them.
I think I have time for one more question.
Sure.
How, like any other organism, how does it expand or not expand? What's outside? Do they have walls? You know, does the city?
No, they have people that
how
live.
How does that work?
They have people that live in cities around, like in Turin, of course, and other neighborhoods. And then what they do is they participate more in the social, spiritual structure. So for, let's say, school meditation and other kinds of activities and things that they would like for the children to be involved in, or they just personally would like to, you know, be more creative and you know, manifest things in those areas of their life, then they participate in that, and maybe, I don't know, once a week or more. And but then they have their own life outside of the Dominator. So you have both. And then you also have satellite centers all over Italy and in Japan and all, and most a lot of countries that have little satellite Dominator centers that practice some of the pranotherapy and meditation, things like that. And our website, lahochicenter.com, lahochicenter.com, has information about events and workshops that we sponsor. So we're a center here in North Carolina. We're in the Asheville area of North Carolina, and we have some events coming up here in May, and we'll be offering workshops and seminars from Dominator. They're going to have ambassadors that come out that are right now traveling in California, and they've gone up into Seattle. And so we sponsor those ambassadors to teach these things and to talk about what it's like to live there, and also to inspire people in this country to create more intentional communities that are going to be for the benefit of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is.
Are you doing anything similar? I don't want to call it colonization because that's a negative term. Okay, so we are back, and I am Emmy Louie, and we've ran out of time. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show, and namaste.